Greetings again, everyone. Good to be back again, even though I'm still not quite over the jet lag. I have these moments during the day when I have this very deep kind of a tiredness. So if in the middle of a conjunction or an adverb, I suddenly just ease down onto the floor and you hear me snore for a while, don't worry about a thing. Give me about 10 minutes and then gently wake me up and I'll know where I am again. We were forced to spend one night in New York we didn't want to spend because, of course, on Wednesday, our time over there, we got up pretty early and had to leave the hotel in Amman to go to the airport by about 9:30. And it took a good little while to clear through customs and have all that arranged for us and board the aircraft about 40 minutes later than we should have. We were supposed to leave by about 11, and one of the crew members said if they left before 12, they would eat their shoes. Well, we ended up leaving at about something like, I think, 20 to 1 or so. And then it's about 4 hours and 25 minutes on that aircraft to a refueling stop in Vienna. Normally they're an hour on the ground there, and they were closer to 2 hours on the ground. So we got back in the air, this aboard a 747. And while a 747 looks like a very beautiful airplane from a distance, and I'm sure it must be marvelous to be in the cockpit and to fly it, back in the economy section it looks more like a cattle car, a combination day school, child care center, old folks home, and a tourist trap. You're there with not quite enough room to let your elbows relax. About like if that little narrow chair you're sitting in had arms coming straight out from the side. And of course, it was another 9 hours from there to New York City. And once in a while, the children running up and down the aisle, and of course, people trying to sleep in those conditions are almost impossible. So we're groaning away through the skies over the Atlantic, somewhere south of Iceland and Greenland, and of course, on over Nova Scotia and down along the coast of New England to New York. And got in at about 8-something New York time after a trip somewhere around 19 hours, I imagine. And just a little too late to catch our connection out of there to come on down to Dallas and be met and come on home and get home exhausted on Wednesday night. So we had to find a hotel right near the airport and spend the night, get up and leave at 7:40 a.m. the next morning and come into Dallas-Fort Worth. And then come on over to Tyler, where we arrived about 1:15 or so in the afternoon on Thanksgiving. But it didn't work out all that badly because the night's sleep we got in New York kind of helped us recuperate a little bit. It was pretty much the same way going over there. It's kind of a form of torture to take that kind of a trip. You don't mind being there, and it's great to be there, and it's great to get back, but the agony of the travel in between is a little different than the way I was blessed by being able to travel for about 9 years. When you're in the cockpit of a Fanjet Falcon and flying yourself across the Atlantic and stopping at reasonable times and getting a night's sleep, it's far different than the way people travel aboard these flying cattle cars that they call 747s. I think a lot of you are aware of what's been happening in the work. I want to recap that quickly. We have had a very poor week, but I think the reasons for that are the holiday, that we only had mail from Monday through Wednesday, and the end of the month. And perhaps by Monday we'll have a little pickup there. We certainly hope so, because otherwise it'll be very bad indeed. But I won't elaborate on that. I think there are reasons for it. The groundbreaking of our new building should be perhaps in a couple of weeks or less. I think we're right down to the final okay on the plans now, and it does appear with just a few adjustments, we may not be able to have the portico out in front to drive under and keep people dry that we'd hoped we could have, and a few other minor things that I think we can get the price down to where we can give the final go-ahead, and perhaps in a couple of weeks, and we'll keep you informed, we will be having a groundbreaking out there and be on the way toward our own facilities. As a result of the Middle Eastern trip, we're going to try to put together a special edition of the International News, and it'll be chock full of articles only on the ongoing Middle Eastern crisis, and we'll have articles from every conceivable point of view to really bring people into the picture and tell them what's going on. And that's a little bit of what I'll be talking about today. And we'll be sending copies of that to the Information Ministry and to His Highness Crown Prince Hassan and, of course, to the embassy and all of the people over there. I'm sure will be very pleased in the approach that we have to interviewing these people, because unlike many of the news media in this country, we do not go in with a pro-Israeli, political, or anti-Arab point of view. Neither do we go in with an anti-Israeli, pro-Arab point of view. We go in with a humanitarian, apolitical, completely objective and unbiased point of view, and when they want to answer a question from their point of view, we let them do so. And they know that we're going to give them fair treatment and that what they say is not going to be edited out. They asked us that specifically because when the Crown Prince was in this country, someone asked him a question and he was answering it at some length, and they took out the main point he wanted to make, which would have put a different twist on his answer, and left only the first part in. And they get very incensed about this. Well, as someone who's been on that end of many, many dozens of interviews where people have twisted what I have said, more especially in newspapers than in any other medium, but to some extent in the electronic media, I know how they feel. So we always try to be very fair when we do these interviews. We had an opportunity to talk with at least two professional families, doctors who live there, and then with Dr. Nasser, who is the head of the Birzeit University that you've heard of recently, I think, been closed several times for a few weeks or a couple of months at a time, and now it's been closed again recently by the Israeli government. Birzeit is a small town near Ramallah on the northeast of the old city of Jerusalem, and had been headed by this man, Dr. Nasser, until he was expelled about a year or so ago, and he's been living over in Amman and trying to run it from there. People come back and forth, and of course he is a member of the PLO. So from the Israeli point of view, they get very, very tired indeed of student demonstrations, of Molotov cocktails, of riots and so on, not on campus, but students that go to Birzeit who will attack buses or Israeli jeeps or military trucks or what have you. And finally, when they get just totally fed up with it, they just close the university for a couple of months. But of course, again, when you hear it from their point of view, you hear of the terrible, oppressive Israeli government. One of these gentlemen went so far, if you can believe this, as to say that the Israelis are perpetrating acts upon the people living in the West Bank that is unlike anything, even including the Nazi regime under Adolf Hitler. Now, you get an education when you understand that that man really believed that, and he really did think that that is the way it is. That is his perspective. And it's quite an education to listen to what they have to say about what's happening over there. We interviewed also, of course, the Crown Prince of Jordan, and we had quite a good time over there meeting many of these people and getting to know them. They're very lovable people. In their way, you see a kind of a love of humanity and a kind of a friendliness of saying, my home is your home, and they really mean that, inviting you in, and tremendous hosts, very warm. The people that we met, of course, were a certain echelon of the Jordanian government, the professional people and educated people, very literate, sometimes trilingual and so on, and by no means the nomadic Arabs or the illiterate people who might be in a very poverty level of the society. Some of the television shots that were taken by the cameraman and my son Mark went along included shots of the Jordan Valley, the Allenby Bridge, where they got shots of an Israeli soldier waving his arms at them and so on, the sandbags, the Israeli flag, and the fortifications were there, of Amman, the street scenes there in various parts of the capital city of Jordan, that now is perhaps over 1 million. When I was there in 66, it was just under 100,000, of a Palestinian refugee camp in Amman. I think two different shots or so of that. So by the time we put it all together, we will have several on-the-spot radio programs, several, probably more than two, television programs that we will do, and a special edition of the International News, and hopefully an updated version of the booklet or the article we've reprinted on Is Peace or Is War, rather, just ahead in the Middle East. I wanted to recap a little bit of what we did on the trip as I go along by couching it in a sermon on biblical prophecy. And I want to begin by turning to Daniel 11:40, that prophecy that we've just about worn out by referring to it time and again. But it is absolutely a key prophecy for what's going to be happening in the near future. Beginning in verse 40 of Daniel 11, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, with horsemen, with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over." Now again, without going into the long, lengthy explanations that I've done so many times in the past to prove who is the king of the north and who is the king of the south. The king of the north is the beast power, we do believe, of Europe that is yet to emerge. Anciently, they were the Seleucidae of Syria, and these wars raged back and forth through Palestine for many, many years. But notice, the time setting is inescapable. At the time of the end. And that is the time that we have entered since the time of World War I. We have had a round of world wars. We're only in a temporary respite between round three of world war, and we probably will have several other outbreaks of lesser wars, perhaps several in the Middle East yet, before the time of the Great Tribulation and World War III gets going. We do not know the identity of the King of the South as yet. But how many kings could you identify and do you know of who exist in the Middle East? Well, I've just come from a nation that is headed by a king, His Majesty King Hussein of Jordan. You know that King Khalid is the absolute ruler of Saudi Arabia. Of course, there are other kings along North Africa, and there are those who are absolute dictators or despots of other nations that might as well be called a king, whether they take the title of premier or whatever. But there are those kings that exist right now. It may be one of them. It may be Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. It may be the present or a future leader of Egypt that may be able to put it back together again. We don't know who the King of the South is. Remember the UAR back in the 1959 to 61 period when President Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt and the then president of Syria put together the United Arab Republic? That was a move toward Arab unanimity or Arab cooperation in trying to have some kind of a solid front to confront the enemy, Israel. The chief thing that the Israelis have had going for them through all these years is the inability of the many Arab states to cooperate among themselves. Now, the Arab nations represent many, many different racial stocks, even though they may not be aware of it. Everything from Turkoman and Kurds and Syriacs and some of them that call themselves Assyrians, which I think is a misnomer. The people of those ancient races of Edom, Moab, and Ammon that are still in there, they call themselves Arabs. But even in looking at them, you can see a complete difference in color, in the shape of the head and the eyes, the mouth, the nose, and everything between, for example, the Palestinians of the Palestinian Arab area of Jerusalem and its environs in the West Bank, as opposed to the Jordanians that have always lived on the other side of the Jordan River. And the Jordanians, the common people, tend to be much darker, almost black, some of them, very, very swarthy, while the Palestinians are much lighter, very light olive, and almost, you might say, Mediterranean in complexion. Because of that, and because of religion. And none of those nations really get along all that well together. You can take a look at the fact that the Iranian people are from the steppes of Russia, and the high plains of the plains of Kabbalah and the Iranian littoral, where the people next to them over in Baghdad and the drainage valleys of the Tigris and Euphrates River, are Arab stock in Iraq. Now, the Iraqis tend to be a very fierce kind of an Arab stock of people. They're very warlike. And both of these nations are Muslim, believers in the teachings of the Prophet Muhammad, continually praying five times a day and listening to the reading of the Quran, but the Iranians are not Arab racially. They are Muslim religiously. And here are these two nations going at it in a war right now. Looking at the divisions in other nations, you have North and South Yemen, and those are Yemenis, they're both the same peoples, but politically, South Yemen is in the Russian sphere of influence and supplied by the Soviet Union, and North Yemen is not. You have the peoples of North Africa. Many of them are Muslim, and many of them are African stock, such as in the Sudan and Mauritania and elsewhere. And you have a combination of Coptic Christians, of Muslims, of various different beliefs, such as the Sunni and the Shiite Muslims. You have very fanatical readers of the Quran who want to interpret it literally, and you have those that tend to be a little looser with it. The Quran, for example, would not even allow that there is a king over a nation. And so technically, in Jordan, King Hussein shouldn't even exist. They shouldn't have that kind of a government. In the nation of Jordan, if you check into a hotel, you can go to the bar and have a beer made in Jordan under Dutch license called Amstel. If you check into a hotel in Saudi Arabia, there is no bar. And if you get caught with alcoholic beverages, you can be in serious trouble. When the mosque in Mecca was taken over, many Americans that lived down there that had their private smuggled stocks that they managed to bring in, had their own bars, took off into the desert with all of their booze and simply threw it out the window and let it break on the rocks for fear that if these Islamic fundamentalists took over the government, they would have the same type of a thing happen in Saudi Arabia that took place up in Iran, and their lives could be forfeit if these violent, fanatic Muslims found these Westerners with alcohol in their possession. So you see, there is no such thing as harmony and unity in the Arab world. Now, the so-called steadfast front consists of the nations of Libya under Muammar Gaddafi, Syria under Assad, and then, of course, Algeria and South Yemen, with a little assistance from Mauritania in North Africa. These are violently, fiercely anti-Israeli, and call for not just the return of the captured lands of the 1967 Six-Day War in June, but the virtual deportation. And really, in their own hearts and minds, you have to believe they want to see the extermination of the Jewish people of Palestine. They want to return to something that was even pre-1948, if the truth were really told. Now, among those nations is, of course, another non-nation, and the biggest voice of all of them in a way, Yasser Arafat and the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. Arafat travels pretty much back and forth between Syria, Lebanon, where many of the bases are maintained among the refugee camps in the southern Lebanon, and then, of course, down to Libya and to the other nations of this so-called steadfast front. Yasser Arafat is very much a prime figure in all of this because, of course, if you remember, the United Nations gave observer status to the PLO. You may remember the pictures of Yasser Arafat being received like an international hero, waving the olive branch in the one hand, but with his pistol on his hip, clearly visible in the other, to which the Israelis took great exception. Now, since that time, major European nations, even some of those in the EEC, have given observer status, like recognition of the PLO. The Israelis refuse to even acknowledge the PLO. They will not talk with them. They will not admit that the PLO are the, quote, sole representatives of the legitimate territorial aspirations of the Palestinian people. They won't do it. They won't talk to them. All the other Arab states, including the Saudis, say that the PLO represent the sole legitimate representatives of the Palestinians. And they call for the setting up of a West Bank separate Palestinian, a Palestinian nation that would be sovereign over its own territory with its capital, East or Arab or Old Jerusalem. Now, I can go into this point by point and step by step. It's all going to overlap and I don't want to confuse anybody. But let me go back and set the stage a little bit of what happened just after the 1967 war. If I had a map, I would be well served to have a pointer, show you on the map what happened, but certainly by this time you've seen so many maps and newspapers and magazines of it that you're somewhat aware of what happened. The greatest slice of territory lost to any Arab state was the Sinai, but it was undeveloped, almost totally uninhabited, and of course the main slice of pie that the Israelis got was the oil fields that they began to develop, and of course the Mitla and other strategic passes and the building the Barlev line. So it gave them a huge buffer zone between the very large Egyptian army and the nation of Israel. The next most important slice of territory, and the biggest of all in terms of its economic significance, was the West Bank. And that is something like, I forget the number of square miles, something like 2,500 square miles. It's a big piece of property. And it's the entire west bank of the Jordan River, all the way from clear up at the Sea of Galilee, clear down past the Dead Sea. And the nation of Jordan had all of that property, where there are dozens of Arab villages and towns. And, of course, the biggest of all was East Jerusalem, which is part of the West Bank, and some of the other towns and villages there, like Ramallah, as I said, and Birzeit, and many, many others. Now, there were more than 1.2 million, I believe, Palestinian Arabs that were dispossessed as a result of the occupation of the West Bank. Shortly after that occupation, Israeli settlers began to go in and to build their kibbutzim, their farms, and their little villages and towns in the West Bank. And we will show you all of this, including pictures that will just blow your mind in a special upcoming edition of the newspaper. When I talk about Israeli settlements, nothing could be more indicative of the development of those settlements than East Jerusalem. And if you look at a picture of it, you will see great, beautiful, high-rise, solid stone apartments, 10, 12, 14 stories, many, many, many of them, glittering and brand new. And the entire infrastructure of a modern city that has been welded together as if it is one. Now, the word infrastructure was used continually by the Egyptians when I was there because of the terrible conditions in Cairo. But in short, it merely means that if you would really think of the amenities that are provided to you when you check into a hotel in, let's say, New York City. You get into the elevator, you're in a little cage, it takes you nice and silently and very rapidly to the 20th floor. Well, what does it take to run that elevator? What kind of engineering went into it to make sure that it has a certain capacity and it will not break down and it's safe for you and so on? What kind of electrical power? Where is it located? Is it hydraulic or electrical on cables? What are its safe characteristics? Does it have lock where immediately when the power fails it'll stop and won't send you plummeting into the bottom? You go up and you go into your room and you turn on the lights. What does it take to provide you with those lights? You get into the shower and there's clean water. You can drink water out of the tap. What does it take to provide that? Well, it takes a city water system that provides water that is chemically treated to make sure there are no harmful bacteria. When you flush the toilet, where does it go? Well, it goes down between the walls, past the people 19 floors below, something you don't want to think about, and down into the street, and down the middle of the street in great big pipes, and over to a sewage treatment plant somewhere. When you get out in the street and you hail a taxi, well, there's a curb, and there's a street out there, and there are stoplights. So here's a complete grid of electrical systems, of cables, and of sewage pipes, and of water lines, and of electrical conduit. Here are bus lines, and newspapers, and schools, and traffic systems, and it's a completely integrated, harmonious, modern technology that is providing a decent way of life for thousands and thousands of people. Now, when you think of the old city of Jerusalem and East Jerusalem and its environs outside of the walls of the old city, and then West Jerusalem, when they cleared out all of that rubble of no man's land that had existed for approximately 19 years, from 1948 to 1967, prior to that war, they began building immediately. They built streets and roadways. They began building apartment buildings and commercial buildings and single-family residences and so on. And they have linked the bus lines and the sewage systems and the water mains and the electrical systems and so on, all linked together. So that Jerusalem is as much one city as is Chicago or Los Angeles or any other city that is one harmonious city all linked together. Now, in the call, almost immediately, within months after the 67 war, from the United Nations to pass a resolution, and you can laugh about the United Nations because they have no teeth, they have no means of enforcing their resolutions, but Resolution 242, you've heard about it for the last X number of years, was the resolution that called for the return of all of the, quote, occupied lands. And that began the sticky process that has continually boiled up in the form of wars, the Yom Kippur War of 1973. It will boil up again and again in southern Lebanon. It's going to boil over eventually, as we will see from Bible prophecy. And believe it or not, may be the very pivotal point that begins World War III and a nuclear bomb war in the area. Now, on the Israeli part, when you go over there and you talk to the Israeli leadership, and it can be a very emotional experience in talking to some of them, and you hear what the conditions were prior to the 1967 war. I was there in 1966. We walked across that no man's land and carried our bags into the new city of Jerusalem and stayed in the King David Hotel. And we were so relieved to get to Israel because conditions in the Arab side were just abominable. It was like uninhabitable. You went around clutching your stomach. Nothing was fit to eat. Nothing was fit to drink. And you were sick all the time and so on. When you got over there, you began to see what the Jews were doing with Israel. It was verdant. It was green. They had terraced the hills. When you got on down to the maritime plain, your eyes saw endless fields of wheat and of grain, of every kind of vegetable, of permanent crops such as orchards and citrus fruit just everywhere, and everything was green and golden brown, and as far as you saw, there was just marvelous construction and planting and building and reclamation, and they were clearing the rocks out of the old rocky hills and terracing them and planting olive groves and so on. And it was just marvelous what you saw going on. So during all of this time, from 1948, and that's another whole story I won't take time to tell you here, but we can have perhaps articles dealing with that in the pre-1948 period, the Jews were denied access to the holiest place to them, the Wailing Wall and David's tomb. They could see it from a distance, but they couldn't get close to it. Now, we went to the Wailing Wall in 1966, and to get there, you would walk down narrow corridors of dismal streets of hovels made out of stone that had been there for perhaps hundreds of years in an Arab quarter of the old city of Jerusalem. And they were several stories high. The stench was overpowering. The very primitive, if any, indoor facilities and so on. And this old city had been there, as I say, for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it was just a stench that you can't believe, and it was atrocious. Now, when you got to the Wailing Wall, you had your back to these old Arab hovels, and you could probably, it was not quite as far away from me as this back brick wall is here in the pulpit, when you actually saw this one portion of the exposed walls of what used to be the temple of the Herodian period, a part of the very walls that were there when Christ and his disciples walked about in the temple during the time of Christ. And this was the holiest place to the Jews, but they couldn't see it. And they couldn't get to it. To get to it, you had to take this guide to walk through this labyrinth of this ancient old hovel, you know, group of hovels of Arab buildings. One of the first things the Jews did after they won back old Jerusalem in the 67 war was to go in there and to dispossess all these people out of this one area of Arab Jerusalem, take these big bulldozers in there, and just wipe out this whole area of a slum. That's what it was. It was an Arab slum. And they just bulldozed it flat. Now today, when you go to visit the wall, which some of you may have done, you see this huge big square. And it has a built-up balustrade and steps down. Then there's another flat area that has stones placed on it. And the wall is just wide open. There's room there for thousands of people to gather. Flagpoles there with the flag snapping in the breeze, right up above it, the Dome of the Rock, and you climb up and you go up toward the Al-Aqsa, and there's another area there where they claim is David's tomb, and these pilgrims are going up there, and the Jews are putting on the yarmulke and going up and bowing and scraping, and the Hadzik and the others, some of these Jews, the ultra-Orthodox, are standing there before the wall and bowing endlessly with their little prayer books and sticking the little folded-up notes, you know, of prayers in between the stones of the rock, just having a marvelous time. Now, as they began to settle the West Bank and to build these villages and cities, they began to do in other areas of the West Bank exactly what they'd done in East Jerusalem. They went out into fields. And here Arab families for centuries had been climbing up these rocky outcroppings and knolls. And here's a little bit of dirt in a kind of a rocky trench. And they would take an ancient old hole of some sort and they would grub around in the rocks. They would never think to pull the rocks out of this area and to terrace it or to develop it, but whatever was there, they would grow wheat and they would grow other crops. They never did very much to the land. It was all just very much primitive. You know, there was no irrigation of it. It was dry land farming, etc. The water, well, the water was either where the water was, where you found water. And wherever you found water, there would probably be a village. So there'd be a spring gurgling out of the ground somewhere. There'd be an Arab village there, been there for centuries. And they just loved this way of life with their goat herds and their camels and their dry land farming without any development or irrigation. So one day, along in the distance, they saw this truck coming along, and here came some guys piled out, set up these tripods, and began shooting the land. And we even have some film, I think, from the Jordanians that gave us quite a scene of these Arabs going up and screaming and yelling and telling off these Israeli surveyors because they knew what was going to follow. And it just about got to a point of violence. I mean, they were really getting angry. Well, of course, a few days later, here would come the rumble of a lot of trucks, a couple of D9 Caterpillars, and these Arabs sat there in their village and watched this whole hillside being torn up by these Caterpillars and so on. Well, then along come a bunch of Israeli contractors. They come down into the village, and they hire the Arabs. We need people to get up here and chisel stone. Well, the Arabs are pretty good at that. And, carry hod or whatever. And it's something that really annoys them when you talk to them today, that Arabs have been, quote, forced, end quote. Well, not at gunpoint. But the Israelis come along and offer good wages for a good day's work. And the Arabs, even though they're mad about it and embittered, seem to have no other choice. And so the labor that they use to construct these many, many buildings all over the West Bank is basically Arab. And the Arabs are building all these buildings to house Jews. Well, the Arab goes back at night into his village. Well, they come along, and pretty soon, in the course of a couple of years or so, where there was nothing but just barren land, is a whole township of 10 or 20 of these high-rise apartments, many, many single-family residences, shopping centers, commercial buildings. The Jews are out farming the soil. They've put down deep water wells. They are irrigating. They're planting orchards. They're growing apples and oranges and bananas and whatnot. And they're just living life there. Now, these colonies can be a youth camp. It can be a group of people from Russia. The Jewish government has tended to get rid of a lot of their otherwise very sticky problems by taking certain fanatical sects, let's say, of Yemeni or Moroccan Jews or Jews from Russia or the Ukraine, and settle them here. If a whole group came in from one area of the Eastern world, they might end up in this settlement. Another group end up in another settlement. And these settlements are like, as I say, townships or small cities. Well, after a while, as they're irrigating, and they even showed us one picture that showed these huge rain birds and the water just spraying on the fields out here. It was really a beautiful picture. But to our hosts over there, it was something that made them absolutely furious. And then here in the old Arab village, by and by, the old spring dries up because the deep water is being taken out of the ground to irrigate the Israeli crops. So the Arabs have no choice but to abandon the village. Now comes the human part of this that I want you to understand. Tens of thousands of Arab families live in refugee camps. To describe a refugee camp is impossible except to say that if all of us, thousands more like us, were suddenly to simply have soldiers show up, pound on your door, and at the point of a bayonet say, go, and give you maybe 10 minutes to gather what you could, including the birdcage. That's it. Go. Whatever you can carry in your back. Leave it all. Everything stays there. And the minute you're gone, you hear an explosion and turn around, and your house has just been blown sky high. And you're herded into a truck or an old bus, and you're simply taken to a border, and you're told, go. You get out of the truck, and you cross the bridge, and there is your host, the nation of Jordan, or the army of Lebanon, or whatever. And they don't know what to do with you, because they're not going to take Lebanese or Jordanians and kick them out of their home and say, we got a house for you. And what government is going to tell anybody, here's your new home? So they just put aside areas of uninhabited land. And they say, we'll let you build here. And they do their best to provide various building materials, corrugated tin, cardboard, whatever they can pick up. So springing up out here in tents and temporary dwelling places is a village of thousands of people who have no sanitary facilities, no flushing toilets, no water, no nothing. At first, maybe the water has to be trucked in tins. Later on, they might put down wells. Maybe it's around an old village where there is some kind of water. But just totally camping out. Now, the years go by. All of this happened, remember, in 1967. This is now 1981. There are children now, 14, 13, 12, who were born after the 1967 war. What have these kids been taught in those refugee camps? And when you go there, as Mark did, and I've been to other places, I wanted to do some radio programs and dictate some articles for the paper. So on the day they drove down where they could get a view of the West Bank, the Allenby Bridge, I stayed in the hotel and worked on that day. But they went down there and went to the refugee camp. And it's indescribable, but you can see children playing in little rivulets, but the rivulets come out from underneath a collection of hundreds of homes, and what's running in the little rivulets is urine. And they're damming it up and making little boats and playing in it, you know. And it's human excrement and so on. This is what they're playing in out there. Now, the way these people grow up is just, well, it's so inhuman that most of us in this very blessed country would never think of allowing our dog to live in the kind of a mess that those people have to live in. We would just, our hearts would break for our dogs. We would want to clean out the cage. You know, you wouldn't let your canary live in that kind of an environment. Now, maybe the old home from which the family was evicted and which was blown up would look to us like a hovel. It probably would in most cases. It would look like a slum. We would say it was awful. But now, everything is relative. And if you lived in a stone building, which was pretty cool in the summer and fairly warm in the winter, and while it was rather primitive, it was yours, and it had been your father's and his father's. And outside were some rocky hillsides and a little bit of grass up here and some old gnarled trees, and you knew where there was a little spring with a couple of fruit trees nearby or whatever. And this is where you grew up. Then your recollections of the old life would be pretty poignant to you, pretty nostalgic. And you would rear your kids on a diet of how you were evicted, what the Israelis did, the horrible things you saw, and how they took away your home and they blew it up and they came in with their tractors and they tore up everything in sight and they dried up the wells and someday we're going to get it all back. Well, now, you know, when those people have been forced to remain in those refugee camps for now nearly 15 solid years, and there are hundreds of thousands of them in Lebanon, what do you suppose these young teenagers who were 3 and 5 and 7, and now they're up in their 20s, many of them as little babes remembered some of that, and they're in southern Lebanon, what do you suppose their attitude is toward the Israelis? Well, of course, that's where you get these fanatics who will come across in 3s and 5s and simply find a bus, as they did here a year and a half or so ago on the way to Tel Aviv. And it was a girl who was their leader. And take their submachine guns, and here is a bus filled with holiday goers, women and kids, and just machine gun the bus. And that's exactly what they did and killed a whole lot of people. The Israelis killed some of them. And now, recently, there was a group who... probably they were indigenous, they were in the land, who attacked a mayor, and his son happened to be riding with him, of one of the West Bank towns. Because, you see, the Israelis have begun to really work on these West Bank mayors. And a lot of the West Bank mayors of the Arab townships have wanted to cooperate and have wanted to go along toward the idea of, quote, autonomy, end quote, why I've corrected myself earlier. Because autonomy to the Israeli government means that they would like to see the West Bank have an autonomy, but ultimately still remain under military control, and the ultimate power would be the Prime Minister of Israel and the Knesset, even though they would have their local leadership and have their own parliament, as it were, and be sort of self-administered, like a state, let's say, like statehood. The ultimate power would still be the Israeli government. This makes the Arabs absolutely fly into a frenzy. It just makes them furious. They can't stand to think of the Israeli idea of autonomy. So this gives you a little bit of the picture of the feelings that exist in the area. And frankly, when you listen to them, you understand and you even have a certain amount of sympathy with both points of view. Now, let me take you back in history with a little bit of an analogy that I've given before so you understand even better, perhaps. This idea of historical or even biblical justification as to who owns the land is nothing new. When you go back to some of the claims of people, even in this United States of America, do you know that there have been Indian tribes who have descended upon Washington and have gotten huge settlements at this late date in the 70s? Because of allegations about deprivation of national and tribal lands taken by the U.S. government way back in 1840? It's true. You've heard of lawsuits, which still are pending in federal courts, of certain Indian tribes that want to get back a slice of Manhattan. Now think about it. If we went through the self-righteous process of giving it all back, where would we start? Well, in the United States, we would have to give back the land, of course, to the original inhabitants, but it would have to be step by step. We would have to give back all of the central section of the United States from the plains up in Nebraska, Montana, and Wyoming, all the way down to New Orleans to the French, because we bought it at the time of the Louisiana Purchase, and it was a dirty deal. We got a lot more than we should have for our money. Well, we'd have to give back Colorado and Nevada and all those southwestern states, including most of California, up to the Bay Area, to Mexico. Now, the Bay Area would have to be given back to the Russians, who had a colony there before we did. Alaska would go back to the Russians, but then the Russians would have to give it back to the Aleuts and the Eskimos because they were there first. And then when Mexico had the southern part of California, they would have to give it back to all of the Indian tribes. But those tribes would have to give it back to the other tribes from whom they took it originally. Now, the Arabs have a claim that go back hundreds of years. Study the Ottoman Empire. Study how Suleiman the Great managed to get enough warriors together that they had a huge uprising and managed to overthrow the yoke of the Turks with British help and to get back that whole area that eventually became a British mandate called Transjordan. You know, Jordan has not even been a nation in that sense and hasn't been called the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan except since about 1959, I believe. It's very new in history. The people are old. The roots go back very, very far, but they do not go back to the same claims that the Jews have upon the land. Another thing that is making them very mad right now is that Menachem Begin insists upon calling those portions around Jerusalem Judea and Samaria, biblical terminology. And the Crown Prince mentioned this in his interview, which you will see on television. So this makes them very angry, because the Jews are trying to establish historical and even biblical justification for having a claim which is transcendental and which is an older claim to the land than do the Arabs. The Arabs' claim goes back centuries, but the Jews' claim goes back more centuries. And so here is an absolute, it's an insoluble problem. There is no way it's ever going to be solved, not now and not until the coming of Jesus Christ to this earth. That's why it is such a violent area of the world, and there is going to be no nice, peaceful settlement in the Middle East. It is impossible. The Jews have gone too far. There has been total colonization and annexation of those lands, and the Arabs are furious. Now, they tried one... Oh, to my statement, a very nice man that I immediately liked, and he was a former information minister to the throne, whose name was... Tuma Hazu. Well, Tuma means Thomas in the Arabic. And Tuma works right there in the office where we were on a couple of occasions, that is the office of the Crown Prince. And he told me this story at dinner. He said, you know, when you look into the Bible, and he is a Christian, quote unquote, he told me about his background. It's kind of like the Coptic Christians, but it's a group of Arabs that come from clear up in the north part, right along the Syrian border, that are Christian, that go back centuries and centuries, that worship Christ as the Savior. But even with his so-called Christianity, he came up with this statement. He said, a lot of people ask, what kind of a God was it who sent Abraham into a land that was occupied by other people? He wanted to know, what was my answer to that? I said, well, my answer to that is that God is God, and that God told the Israelites, and I gave the example, of course, of the Israelites under Moses as well as Abraham. In the first place, Abraham went to a largely uninhabited land, which had the same problems when you want to talk about South Africa and the claim of the blacks and the claim of the British and the Dutch, who were there first, and the blacks migrated down much, much later, and the blacks claim it's their land, but the British were there first because it was virtually uninhabited when they arrived there. So this is a problem that is really universal. It happens all over the world. North Ireland, same problem. But I explained that when these tribes had degenerated into polytheistic paganism and were guilty of human sacrifice, of causing their children to pass through the fire to Dagon and so on, they were not fit to live, and that God used Israel as a force in his own hands to exterminate these people who were so utterly degenerate that in God's point of view, they simply didn't deserve to live. My answer was not really satisfactory to Tuma. He didn't like exactly what I said. He was very friendly, but it's an interesting thought, isn't it, to show you how deeply entrenched is the Arab point of view. Whose land is this? And they, of course, cite Zionism and the idea of Eretz Israel. Well, as you know, only since my trip over there and since my return, the very much touted conference of Fez, Morocco fell apart. They had hoped that that was going to be a big step forward. It was heralded as the biggest step since the Camp David Accords, and everybody was calling for unity. Well, of course, the Saudi king did, and the Saudi crown prince Fahd, who came up with the 8-point peace plan, and everybody else, including King Hussein, got in the act and said, let's have unity, let's have togetherness, let's sit down and talk. So they went to Fez after several days' preliminary talks and squabbling over the agenda. Well, the PLO was represented, but it was sabotaged pretty much by Assad of Syria, who refused to come. And this so-called, as I said, steadfast front were bad-mouthing it, and the one thing they wanted this council to adopt, this great big meeting to adopt, in addition to the 8-point peace plan, was the legitimate claims of the Palestinians for their own sovereign state. Well, somewhat of a shouting match developed, apparently, when King, his name is Hassan, and or is it Hassad, it's spelled with H, of Morocco, who was really the host, simply canceled the conference. And he and Yasser Arafat got into kind of a shouting match, and Arafat demanded that they discuss the Palestinian problem, and the king came back and said, that's all we've been discussing, and so on. And so it must have been horribly embarrassing, because the big news in the newspaper every day we were in Amman was that King Hussein is going, and everybody else is going. And an entourage left the day before. Finally, the day before we left, King Hussein leaves for the Fez conference. And it was just article after article about the big Fez conference, and who's going to be there, what's going to happen. They're going to discuss this 8-point peace plan. They're all going to get together. Speculation about European support, United States support. They know that the only way to get what they want is the big powers to pressure Israel. They told us you've got to cut off your support of Israel. And they're very upset because of the American press, the American movie industry, the American economy that is so heavily influenced by the Jewish element, which is obvious. I mean, are the Arabs going to come over here and make a movie like Exodus? The Arabs are not the people in Hollywood. The Jews are. The Arabs are not in high finance in the United States. The Jews are. The Arabs are not high up in government. The Jews are. The Arabs are not very, very prominent in Wall Street. The Jews are. And, of course, the Arabs know this, and it makes them just bitterly angry. So they were really hoping that at long last, the Fez conference was going to show a united Arab front and be a major step forward in getting that old Resolution 242 passed. Well, it fell apart in 5 hours. While we were in the air en route, I didn't learn about it until I got to New York City. So I hope that this is interesting. I imagine I'm losing some of you and are going to sleep. But it is, I'll tell you, critical because it is going to be the very thing that brings about World War III. Let me show you something quickly. When it says the King of the South, I don't know who that is yet, but it is the following. It is a prominent Arab leader that is going to put together some kind of a united Arab bloc of nations who will either A, cut off oil or in some way interfere with the flow of oil or other very vital and strategic materials to this beast power, or B, maybe in a limited sense, occupy a portion of land, even perhaps which is being occupied, and I think this is important in the light of what's happening right now, by April of 1982, when the final third part of the Camp David Peace Accord is to take place, which is the final withdrawal from all Israeli troops in the Sinai. And as you know, even while we were gone, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Italy, together with one other nation which I've forgotten, I think Sweden, yeah, that's a four-nation group, are providing troops to go into the Sinai and to represent a peacekeeping force between the Egyptians and the Israelis. All right, the scenario could be that perhaps there are major elements of European armies in the area, even as a peacekeeping force. Could this push at him be an invasion which kills many of them? I don't know. But the King of the South does something that causes a violent reaction. And what happens? Verse 41, he shall enter into the glorious land. We've read it many, many times. That's Palestine with its capital in Jerusalem. Many countries shall be overthrown, and there are many countries in the region. Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Iraq and Iran up there, of course, all the Gulf states, Abu Dhabi, Bahrain, Dharan, Dubai, Saudi Arabia, as I said, North Yemen, South Yemen, all the rest of them, Kuwait, Oman, and so on. But these shall escape out of his hand. And it seems to draw a line right down the River Jordan, even Edom, that's Turkey, and Moab, which I believe to be Iraq, and the chief of the children of Ammon, which are the Hashemites of Jordan, its capital city, is called Ammon or Ammon. And a biblical prophecy very clearly shows that they were to stay in their ancient land. He, this beast power of the United States of Europe, shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, meaning the lands in that area, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Never before more literally true and couldn't be understood in a context except in today's context of history where Egypt and Israel are in some sort of accord. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. And the Libyans, that doesn't mean necessarily the geographical entity of Libya, of the political entity under Gaddafi. It could mean push, or I should say Kush and Put, which could mean really the people over in Pakistan and also in India. And Ethiopians shall be at his steps, meaning at the border. He doesn't occupy those countries. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas, reference to Jerusalem, in the glorious holy mountain. Yet shall he come to his end, and none shall help him. Scenario is that a military force is going to occupy the land of Palestine, and at that time, the Pope is going to move the Vatican to try to settle the problem by declaring Jerusalem an international city. I asked the Crown Prince about that, and he cited, of course, an earlier Vatican document in which the Pope had long before called for Jerusalem as an international city. I asked him to this effect, do you believe that the Pope will lend his good offices to solving a problem in the Middle East by even coming to Jerusalem or by declaring it as an open city? And he answered about an earlier Vatican declaration which had called for Jerusalem as an international city. Most Americans have forgotten that in the 1948 UN resolution, a part of that which recognized and established a Jewish state was also that Jerusalem, the old city, should be internationalized. When a war broke out and the Jordanians tried to encircle, which they did, New Jerusalem, the people were starving to death. It's a long story. The relief column that was armored got to them, saved thousands of Jews from sure extermination, and incidentally put Israeli military presence in the city, gave them a corridor of approach to it, and of course they grabbed the western part. Jordan kept the eastern part, and instead of it being internationalized, Jews were even kept from going there. And that prevailed from 48 to 67. Now, quickly, to the 25th chapter of the book of Ezekiel, because this is a prophecy about the nation of Jordan and Ammon. Set thy face against the Ammonites and prophesy against them, verse 2, and say unto the Ammonites, hear the word of the Lord Eternal, thus says the Lord God, because you said, aha, against my sanctuary, when it was profaned. Now Matthew 24 and Luke 21 say, watch, and we're to watch for two key things, Jerusalem surrounded with armies, and the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place where it ought not. That means the destruction of Jerusalem and of modern Israel is prophesied in the Bible. And it's going to be a great and a massive tragedy. Tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe a million or more Jews are going to die. And it's going to be the worst thing that has ever happened to them, even worse than the Holocaust under Hitler. And this time it could even mean nuclear war. These other nations around there in the area are going to be delighted when the beast power comes in and attacks and occupies Israel. Now, because you said, aha, against my sanctuary when it was profaned, and against the land of Israel when it was desolate, and against the house of Judah when they went into captivity, behold, I would deliver you to the men of the east for a possession, and you can look for corroboration to that in Isaiah 13, verse 17, which is the setting of the day of the Lord, and talks about the Elamites. Now, the last verse that we read in Daniel 11, remember, said, tidings out of the north and the east trouble him, therefore he shall go away with great fury to utterly take away many. Once the king of the north, or the United States of Europe, moves into the Middle East, they immediately realize what Soviet reaction is going to be. And traditionally, instead of waiting to be attacked, they get the jump on the Soviet Union, and that great war is going to lead directly to the Battle of Armageddon and is the beginning of the Day of the Lord and God's ultimate intervention. The men of the East who are going to possess the land of Jordan and even Moab, as I'm going to show you in a moment, and Edom, are those peoples of the Soviet Union and their allies. They will set their palaces in thee, etc. Then it begins to mention some of the ancient cities. A little later in chapter 25 and verse 12, thus says the Lord Eternal, because that Edom is dealt against the house of Judah by taking vengeance and is greatly offended and revenged himself upon them, then he says, therefore I will stretch out mine hand upon Edom and will cut off man and beast from it and so on. I will make it desolate from Teman. The Ottoman Empire from the tribe called the Temani is in Turkey, and that's exactly where Edom is today. Turn to the book of Obadiah right quickly, back after Amos in the Minor Prophets. Obadiah, and just before Jonah, which is just before Micah. And it's only a one-page book, so you got to look for it. Obadiah. The vision of Obadiah, thus says the Eternal God concerning Edom, we have heard a rumor from the Eternal, and an ambassador is sent among the heathen. Arise, and let us rise up against her in battle. Behold, I have made you small among the heathen. You are greatly despised. Now, this is the nation of Turkey. And if there is any nation that is any more hated, it is hated in the Middle East, and it's hated in the Near East. The Greeks hate the Turks, and all of the people around the Turkish borders, including the Syrians and the Arab people, hate the Turks. It goes back for generations because of the occupation of Arab lands under the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire. And they are greatly despised around the world. And then this thing on pride, and you're exalted, and so on. And now in verse 7. All the men of your confederacy have brought you even to the border. The men that were at peace with you have deceived thee, because they're going to cooperate with Europe. And there was talk recently, by the way, of the building of that bridge eventually. We flew right over the Bosphorus Dardanelles on the way back, but I was sitting in the middle and couldn't see it. And prevailed against thee. They that eat your bread have laid a wound unto you. There is no understanding in him. Verse 8, shall I not in that day, says the Eternal, destroy the wise out of Edom, the understanding out of the mount of Esau, and your mighty men, O Teman, from the tribe of Temani, from which we take Ottoman, shall be dismayed to the end that every one of the mount of Esau may be cut off by slaughter. For your violence against your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever. In the day that you stood on the other side, now if you look at the strategic location of Turkey, the Sea of Marmara, the Bosphorus, the Sea of Azov, the Dardanelles leading into the Black Sea, you realize that it, of course, is the bridge between Asia and Europe. In the day that strangers carried away captive his forces, and foreigners entered into his gates, and cast lots upon Jerusalem, began bargaining over who was going to possess it. Even you were as one of them. But you should not have looked on the day of your brother in the day that he became a stranger, neither should you have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction, prophesied by Christ in Matthew 24 and Luke 21. Neither should you have spoken proudly in the day of distress. You should not have entered into the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Now, the day of the calamity of Judah is the great tribulation. Yea, you should not have looked on their affliction in the day of their calamity, nor laid hands on their substance in the day of their calamity. Neither should you have stood in a crossway, the Bosphorus Dardanelles, I believe, in the strategic area of the Anatolian Peninsula there in the Taurus Mountains of southern Turkey, to cut off those of his that did escape. Some of them are going to flee into that area to try to perhaps get up into Europe or somewhere. Neither should you have delivered up those of his that did remain in the day of distress. They're going to betray the Jewish people and even deliver some of them up, and perhaps even people from northwestern Europe that will be in that area. For the day of the Eternal is near upon all the heathen. Now, there's some very mysterious verses here. The time setting is obvious. The tribulation, then the beginning of the day of the Lord, and the second coming of Christ. Notice verse 17. Upon Mount Zion shall be deliverance, there shall be holiness, and the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions, meaning the Turks of today. That's the second coming of Christ and the beginning of the millennium. Notice verse 21. And saviors, plural, this is then after the coming of Christ, when there are many members of the family of God, shall come up on Mount Zion to judge the mount of Esau, and the kingdom shall be eternal. I'd like to take a lot more time with that, but I simply can't today. But I wanted to skim over it quickly to at least give you a little bit of a feel for it. Because I'll tell you, in going over there again and being on the site, it has reawakened certainly in me a great deal more awareness an immediacy of how near we are to the breakout of some real violent happenings in the Middle East. And I think that the sabotage of this conference in Fez by the Syrian leadership is going to be a very, very big thing. The Israelis will look upon it as a tremendous plum for them. You know, they're going to be rejoicing. But it's not going to be all that good news for these other Arab states. And if Menachem Begin, lying in a hospital with his leg in a cast now as a result of a break you heard about, decides to just send the Israeli Air Force in to get those SAM sites in the Bekaa Valley of southern Lebanon, and we're off and running in another round of war in the area. And I can just tell you from the biblical prophecies, and I can tell you from the immovable attitudes on both sides, the Israelis are not going to leave East Jerusalem, not now and not ever. And the Arabs are not going to give up calling for its return. And I ask the Crown Prince this question, and I ask others this question. I said, if the Israelis don't give it back, what will you do? The answer, we have no recourse. We must attempt to take it back by military means. So, I mean, you can just sit here as a citizen in the United States and you can tell your neighbor, war is coming in the Middle East. And when it breaks out, it's going to be a big one. And if in any event that the super sophisticated weapons that are being supplied these people by both the United States and the Soviet Union, F-16s, F-15s, the F-4s that they've still got, tanks, the F-20, the MiG-23s, MiG-25s, the Foxbat that the Soviet Union supplies, SAM sites, the Hawk missile from the United States, SAM sites from the Soviet Union. I don't think there's any way that the cities of Tel Aviv and Haifa and some of the rest of them are going to escape this time. And if major loss of life in the Jewish nation of Israel occurs, I believe the Jews will drop an atom bomb on Damascus. And I think when they do, the big powers are immediately involved. It will be impossible to keep it from spilling over, and you're going to have the beginning of World War III. And this time, the United States is not going to come out the victor. So I don't know. We're going to wake up some morning and see the headlines screaming at us, war breaks out in southern Lebanon. Well, we're going to see again that now we're going to see movement of Europe into the area, and the Arabs are mobilizing, they're buying weapons, they're not really doing what they ought to do from the standpoint of helping their people and developing their land, so much they're spending all of the money they earn on weapons from whoever will sell it to them. So you can only say, you go over there and take a look, that war is coming in the Middle East, and it's going to come in a very few years at the outside. They were saying in a term of months that they've got to get this settled right now, that they see something brand new now happening, especially after April, when the last increment of the Sinai is to be given back to Israel. Of course, what makes the rest of them so mad is they say, well, the Golan belonging to Syria, the West Bank and Jerusalem belonging to Jordan, and the Gaza Strip that belonged and was administered by Egypt, where the Palestinian Arabs, should be given back to its original inhabitants. It's not going to happen. So only war is going to result. Well, I hope that gives you a little bit of insight into it, and I've gone a little over time, so I'll stop with that.